Now, as I was in the back there kind of listening, I thought a lot about where I was on New Year's Eve back in the 60s and the 70s. And as some of you, I'm sure, have jokingly heard me say, I spent 20 years in the 60s. And back when I used to teach public school, I'd say that to my students. You know, I spent 20 years in the 60s, and they'd go, you know, Mr. Burnham, that's not mathematically possible. And I said, well, you know, it may not be mathematically possible, but guess what? I did it. And a lot of those times on New Year's Eve, I didn't tell this part to my students, by the way. I mean, I would sit there drunk or stoned at some New Year's Eve party with some, you know, funny little pointed hat on my head, making what Travis was talking about a little earlier, New Year's resolutions, you know, about how my life was going to be better, how my life was going to be different in the coming year. And a lot of people do that, but when you're doing it with a pointed hat on your head and a few drinks, you sometimes make some pretty strange resolutions. I was reading the other day about a guy who said, I've decided to stop reliving the past so I can spend more time worrying about the future. There was a college student who said, my New Year's resolution is to do less laundry and start using more deodorant. Okay. You know, some resolutions just don't seem to take us, you know, to a particularly better situation than the one that we were in. I did go to the internet, though, this last week or so, and there were some resolutions about driving habits that I did want to pass on to you. If you could put that first slide up there. I do think it is a good idea to always replace the gas nozzle before driving away from the pump so that you don't end up like this BMW with the nozzle there but the hose torn off driving down the road. And can you put up the second slide? Choose your parking place carefully so that your car doesn't end up looking like that metallic accordion up there. And then if you could put the third and final little New Year's resolution. Speed limit 50, your speed 167. Officer, I didn't know I was going quite that quickly. So, you know, I tell you, you can tuck those away. But the thing with most New Year's resolutions, whether they're good or whether they're not so good, is that we have a hard time keeping them. Somebody said they go in one year and out the other. That we start off with these good ideas, and maybe they last for a few months, and then, you know, I want to read my Bible more, I want to pray more, and we work ourselves up into something, and usually those peter out after a bit. And I thought, as I was thinking about that, I remembered an old Laurel and Hardy clip where they're trying to move a box containing a large piano up a long flight of stairs. And we were trying earlier to see if we can get this to work, I think. Let's see if we can get this little 1 or 2 minute clip, and then we'll talk a little bit about what this might mean. See if there's some sound that goes with that. The last thing she says to them is, of all the dumb things, of all the dumb things. And I don't know if you felt that way. Sometimes with a New Year's resolution, it's like you're trying to move a heavy load up a long flight of stairs. And you get partway up and the thing goes back down to the bottom. And then there's usually somebody else standing there. Or maybe it's just a little voice inside your head saying, of all the dumb things, why did I ever try that? Why did I ever undertake that project? And it seems like you're always just back in the same place again. The truth is that God does want to change us. God is in the process of transforming each person here into the image of Christ. And he does want 2007 to be a year in which you and I are more like Jesus than we were in the previous year. And the question is, the question I want to look into tonight is, how does real change take place? How does this take place when God transforms us into the image of Christ? And it's not just some empty New Year's resolution that peters out, that in the few months down the line, there's no real change that's occurred. How does God bring about change in our lives? And I'd like to look with you at one of the famous stories in the New Testament about Jesus walking on water. And this is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and John, but we're going to look at the version out of Matthew, because this particular version also includes the added detail of Peter stepping out of the boat and walking on water. Peter is going to walk on the water just like Jesus does. And hopefully, as we look into this tonight, we'll learn a few lessons about how change takes place. So if you haven't opened your Bibles already, I encourage you to open up to Matthew chapter 14, and we'll be looking at verses 22 to 33. Now, the context here, Jesus is on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. He's just fed the crowd of 5,000 men along with women and children, which is to say he probably fed a crowd of around 10 to 15,000 people. There's a whole big crowd. He multiplied a couple of fish and five little loaves of bread, turned it into enough food to feed the entire crowd. And it says in Matthew that afterwards they picked up 12 basketfuls of leftover pieces, little fish heads or whatever they were, and bread crust. So you got 12 hefty trash bags over here on the side. And then John, in his account, also adds that when the crowd had become fed and the trash had been picked up, they began clamoring for him to become king. That Moses had supernaturally fed the Israelites in the wilderness with manna. Now Jesus was supernaturally feeding them with food. And they said, hey, this guy looks like a great leader. We can get a permanent free lunch. And he's the guy we want to be our king. So that's sort of the setting here. The crowd of 5,000 men plus women and children have been fed. The trash has been picked up. The crowd is clamoring for Jesus to become king. And it says, starting in verse 22, immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Now, it might at first, I think, seem a little strange that Jesus would send the disciples and the crowd away. I mean, here were 15,000 people saying, we want you to be a king. And, you know, if any politician nowadays had 15,000 people say, you know, we want you to be our leader, you'd interpret that as some great, you know, grassroots movement, some great groundswell of popular support. And most politicians would go for that. But Jesus doesn't. He knows that his hour has not yet come, his hour to be publicly proclaimed as Israel's leader. That wouldn't really come until Palm Sunday, as the prophet Zechariah said, behold, your king is coming to you humble and riding on a donkey. That happened on Palm Sunday. And yet soon after Jesus did go into the city, he ended up getting rejected and crucified. But he knew here that his hour had not yet come. The crowd was pushing him to become king, but he was not going to be pressured by the crowd to do something ahead of the Father's timing. Jesus also sends the crowd, as well as the crowd, he sends the disciples away. And it may be that the disciples were getting caught up in all the commotion and they were starting to clamor for Jesus to become king as well. And Jesus is saying, look, I want to get you out of this situation so you don't get pulled further down the wrong road. Now, where, though, I think this starts to tie in a little more deeply with New Year's resolutions and change, Ray Stedman said he thinks something more is going on here. When Jesus sends the disciples alone across the lake and he stays behind, Ray Stedman said he thought that Jesus was going to be testing the disciples to see just how deep their faith really was. Had they been changed by seeing this incredible miracle, how deep was their faith in him? And that in reality is what God is always doing to us. He's always trying to stretch our faith. He's trying to challenge our faith. He's trying to deepen our faith. And he does that by what I call putting us through the school of faith. And in the school of faith, I always say there's a lower division, upper division, and graduate school. Okay. Lower division is you have a trial, you pray, the trial goes away. Upper division, you have a trial, you pray, the trial doesn't go away. Graduate school, you have a trial, you pray, the trial gets worse. This particular thing that we're going to be looking at is what I would call a graduate level course in the school of faith. We're going to see that the trial gets worse, at least for a period of time. So Jesus sends the disciples out across the lake. They go out in obedience to him, doing their best to try and obey him. But the wind and the waves are against them. They can't make much headway as they're going into a headwind. Mark also adds that they were straining at the oars. The word actually means torture. They got to the point where rowing was sheer torture for them. They were agonizing as they were rowing into this headwind. And John also adds that they'd only made it 3 or 4 miles, which was about halfway across the lake. Now, I don't know if for some of you here tonight, perhaps you felt that way at some point in your life. Perhaps you're feeling that way tonight. You set out in obedience to Jesus. You were doing what he told you to do, and all of a sudden you have encountered a storm on the lake. And perhaps you've even gotten to the point where life feels like it is sheer torture for you, and you still have a very long way to go. And on top of that, Jesus feels like he's off on a distant mountain. You're in the storm, and Jesus feels like he's far away. Now, I know, you know, when I first became a Christian, I assumed that life would be easy after I became a Christian. I thought it would be smooth sailing. Like I say, I'd been a stoned out hippie, and I thought, gee, if I become a Christian, all my troubles will be over. And, you know, in some sense that's true because I'm not on the road to hell anymore. But in another sense, my problems, my challenges, the storms in life, in some ways got worse after I became a Christian. Because now God was starting to deal with some of the deeper things in my life. I was starting to battle against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And those things caused me a lot of trouble. There were a lot of storms in my life. There continue to be a lot of storms in my life. Okay, what I'm trying to push towards here as we're talking about New Year's, here is I'm leading up to a somewhat painful point. And that painful point is sometimes God needs to bring us to the end of ourselves before real change is possible. Sometimes God needs to bring us to the end of ourselves before real change is possible. The disciples set out in obedience with the best of intentions, with the best of resolutions. They gave it their best shot. They gave it their best effort. And they got to the point where they were completely exhausted and life felt like it was sheer torture. God sends us into trials to destroy our faith in ourselves so that he might open up the door for us to have greater faith in him. Somebody once said, you're a self-made man, maybe that's why you look so funny. Right? We need to be God-made men, God-made women. And in order to accomplish that, God needs to break us of our self-reliance. He needs to deliver us from our illusions of self-sufficiency. As it says in step one of Alcoholics Anonymous, we need to get to the point where we admitted we were powerless and our lives had become unmanageable. We admitted we were powerless and our lives had become unmanageable. And I would suggest to you that what's going on here at the beginning of the story is Jesus bringing the disciples to step one. He's bringing them to the point where they realize that they are powerless and their lives have become unmanageable. And that is the doorway, that is the entrance to real and lasting change. It's not change, it's not just a bunch of empty New Year's resolutions. God will bring you to the end of yourself, brings me to the end of myself, so that he can deepen my faith and really change me. Somebody said, when you hit rock bottom, you often discover that the rock is Jesus. When you hit rock bottom, you often discover the rock is Jesus. Just about the time we actually do reach the end of ourselves, that's about the time that Jesus shows up. And that's what we're going to see here in the next verses. If you could move to the next slide there. says in verses 25 through 27, during the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." Now, like I said, this is a graduate level class. The trial gets worse. They were physically at the end of themselves. Now they come to be emotionally at the end of themselves. They felt physically tortured. Now they're feeling emotionally terrified. It's the fourth watch of the night. That's between 3 and 6 in the morning. According to the other Gospels, they probably took off in the early evening. Let's say they took off at 6 o'clock in the evening, and now it's 6 o'clock in the morning. They could have been rowing for about 12 hours. And at that point, Jesus shows up walking on the water. And clearly, that is outside of their categories. That's outside of the box, or, you know, kind of bad pun, it's outside of the boat. That God sometimes shows up in a way that's outside of what we imagine possible, outside of what we think is something that we can actually do. And that's kind of what I'm pushing towards here. How does real change take place? Well, God's going to bring you to the end of yourself, and then he's going to show up in a way that's outside of what you think is possible, outside of what you normally consider to be your regular life. And not only that, but sometimes when God actually shows up, he shows up in a way that's a little bit scary to us because it is outside the box. And we misinterpret, we misunderstand, we don't actually see that the one who's come to rescue us and save us, we think it's actually part of the problem. He's the answer, but we misinterpret it and think that it might just be part of the problem. Instead of embracing it, we reject it. It's a little bit like this joke I heard about a guy who was, there was a flood and he was on the roof of his house floating down the river, and he started praying, you know, "God, save me, God, save me." And a couple guys in a boat come by, and they throw him a rope, and he rejects the rope, and he says, no, I'm waiting for God to save me. And then a helicopter comes overhead and lowers a ladder, and the guy says, no, man, I'm waiting for God to save me. And, well, the house goes off a waterfall, and the guy dies. But he gets to heaven, and he says to St. Peter, "Why didn't God save me? Why didn't God save me?" And Peter said, "He sent you a boat. He sent you a helicopter. Why didn't you accept the rescue that God sent to you?" And I think a lot of times it's the same way for us. God sends us a rescue, but we don't recognize it. We're looking for something different, and we don't see the thing that he really has sent to us to help us. And sometimes we even misinterpret it and think it's part of a danger. I know in my own life, like I say, when I was stoned out and drunk, God would send a bunch of Christians into my life. And, you know, they were throwing me the rope. They were lowering me the ladder. But I rejected it. And I'll tell you quite honestly, when people would share with me about the Lord, I got scared. I was frightened. What would it mean if I gave my life to Jesus? I'd become one of those Christians, which I somehow thought meant, you know, hokey, no fun, you know, I'm just going to be waiting for pie in the sky, that my life is going to be utter boredom. Well, you know, utter boredom versus killing myself. I mean, even that should have appealed to me. I didn't realize until much later that the Christian life is the most exciting life there is. If you're looking for excitement, a deep sense of fulfillment, the Christian life is more fulfilling and more exciting than any of those wild parties that I ever went to. Okay. Now, into the midst of all that, as the disciples are feeling tortured, they're feeling terrified, Jesus speaks a word of peace. He says, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." Literally, what he says is, "Take courage. I am. Don't be afraid." He invokes the divine name, I am. I am is present. God is present in the midst of this particular situation. You don't need to be afraid. You can take courage. For me, in my own life, a friend finally encouraged me to start reading the Bible. And even though I'd kind of rejected Christianity, I decided to start at least reading the Bible. And it was while reading the Bible that I really had a sense of the voice of God speaking out of eternity into my life, that it wasn't just a famous book. There was a connection to the God of all eternity speaking into my life, saying, Andy, it's okay. You don't need to be afraid. I love you. I care about you. You can accept me. Okay? So, the idea is God may bring you to the end of yourself. Then he may show up in a way that perhaps you don't expect, and perhaps at the beginning you'll even reject or feel afraid about that way. But God will speak a word of peace into that. Okay, let's look at the last slide, the last verses. Lord, if it is you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Come, he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You of little faith, he said, why did you doubt? And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Now, usually, you know, in doing sermons, the person who's giving the sermon will kind of put the application to the end. But I'm kind of give you the mini version here, just so you can kind of be mulling on this as we're looking for a few minutes at some other things. The question on New Year's is ultimately, is God calling you to step out of some boat tonight? Is God perhaps calling you to come to him in some area of your life that may be outside the box? It may be risky. It may not seem part of what you're familiar with. Is he calling you to take a step out of some boat, and you can trust him that if you keep your eyes on him, you will succeed. You will be able to walk on water, to do those things that were always impossible for you before, but if God is calling you to do them and you keep your eyes on him, you will succeed. Okay, so there's the kind of the application part. What excited me, I guess, when I was reading this is that Jesus does not rebuke Peter. He doesn't say like the lady in the movie that you probably could have heard there, well, of all the dumb things. I mean, Jesus doesn't look at Peter and go, well, of all the dumb things, you want to get out of the boat and go walk on the water. He says, come. You need to step out believing. You need to step out in faith. Now, you could say a lot of things about faith, but the part I just wanted to highlight tonight, at the heart of faith is the idea of active trust. If I say I have faith in an elevator, it means that I'm willing to step into that elevator, push the button, and actively trust that that elevator is going to take me to the 27th floor. If I have faith in an airplane, it means that I'm willing to step inside that airplane, and as it's zooming down the runway, I actively trust that that plane is going to carry me to, whenever, Pakistan or Pittsburgh. There was a guy I was reading about, Charles Blondin. Perhaps some of you have heard of him. He's the most famous tightrope walker in the 19th century. And he strung a rope across Niagara Falls. It was 1,100 feet long, 160 feet above Niagara Falls. And he would tightrope walk across this 1,100-foot long walk. And then that got too easy for him, so he would blindfold himself, and he'd go across blindfolded. And then he would start carrying people on his back. Okay. Well, one day the Prince of Wales came to watch him do this tightrope thing. And Charles Blondin said, I'll carry you across on my back. And you think the prince accepted? No. The prince did not have real faith. The prince did not actively want to trust Charles Blondin. But here in our story, Peter did have real faith. He was willing to actively trust the one who had told him to come. He was willing to step out of the boat and to take some first moves towards following the one who had called him. And for a while, he succeeded, strolling kind of along the waves, just like you and I might stroll down the sidewalk here in Palo Alto. But unfortunately, Peter encountered some trouble. As he was walking on the water, the wind and the waves distracted him, And when he took his eyes off of Jesus, he began to sink, just like he'd gotten out of the boat on any other day. And the idea, the application here is, if God's calling you to come in some area, step out of the boat, but don't let the circumstances of life distract you. Keep your eyes on Jesus, and so long as you've got your eyes on Jesus, you will continue to walk on water. If you take your eyes off Jesus, you look at all these things that are going on around you, it's going to be kind of glug, glug, glug. I think Ray Stedman said that he thinks Peter actually went completely below the water and there were just bubbles with a hand coming up. But just as Peter's about to go under, he utters, I think, the shortest prayer in the entire Bible. Lord, save me. And I think in Greek it's only two words. I think it's just Lord, save, which is basically God, help. Short prayer, God responds to that. Even if we have gotten our eyes off of Jesus, God is gracious. And if we call out to him, even when we're sinking, he will reach his hand down and grab us. Now, back on Wednesday, as I was preparing this sermon, Alyssa Galuli, who's one of our admin people here, I was getting out of my car. Alyssa drives into the parking lot. She says, then she backs up and she says, you have to come listen to this. And I said, oh, what? There was a song on, some of you I'm sure are familiar with it, by Stephen Curtis Chapman called The Voice of Truth. And she said, this fits perfectly with your sermon. It fits perfectly with your sermon. So I said, okay. I want to play that for you because sometimes someone once said things that are too sensitive to be said have to be sung. Things that are too sensitive to be said have to be sung. I want you to listen to this, and I believe the words will be up there. Pay attention particularly to the first verse, which I think relates here to the sermon. It says, oh, what I would do to have the kind of faith it takes to climb out of this boat I'm in onto the crashing waves, to step out of my comfort zone into the realm of the unknown where Jesus is and he's holding out his hand. Now, where I'd like to end it here tonight is by reminding you of that application piece. I deeply believe that God is calling each person here to step out of some boat this year, to step out of your comfort zone, to step out of my comfort zone, into some realm that's perhaps seemed impossible to us before. Perhaps he's calling you to step into battling some addiction that's kept you beaten. Drugs, alcohol, pornography, eating disorders. Perhaps he's calling you to battle some habit that you've always had. You've always gotten angry easily. You're full of lust. You're full of self-pity. Perhaps he's calling you to step out into some area of ministry that you thought was impossible that you couldn't do. For some of you here tonight, perhaps he's calling you to come to him for the very first time in your whole life. Perhaps you're afraid of becoming a Christian like I was for so many years. But it says in Romans 10:9, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, if you sincerely declare that you have put your faith in Jesus Christ and he is the one ruling and reigning over your life, and if you have come to believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, that you have come into a relationship with the one who has conquered physical death, you will be saved. You will have stepped out of the boat for the very first time and entered into relationship with the creator of the universe and become one of his followers. Now, no matter what boat God's calling you to step out of tonight, I pray you'll give that some serious thought, some serious reflection. And in order to give you some time to do that, we're going to spend maybe 8 or 10 minutes on communion. That sounds like a wonderful way to end one year and begin the next. Communion is a time of thankful remembrance for what Jesus has done for us, a time we remember his death for our sins as well as the new life that we have in him. Paul says, however, in 1 Corinthians, a man ought to examine himself before he eats of the bread and drinks of the cup. And I would like to encourage you to take some time to reflect. Perhaps God is calling you to step out of some boat, to refocus on him, to remember him. I'm going to pray, and then you can come forward, or I think there are also a couple of goblets and some of the bread in the back. Spend a few minutes praying, asking of God's perhaps calling you. And then Gay is going to come up and ask if anybody would like to share, perhaps, about what you think God is calling you to do in the new year. What area is He calling you to come in? Let's pray. Lord, I do. I thank You so much for the close of the old year and the start of the new. And I do pray, Lord, that this would be a year in which each person here would see dramatic changes in their walk with You, that they would hear Your voice calling them to come out onto the crashing waves. I thank You so much for Your death for us, the new life that we have because of that. I pray that You would bring that to each person here in a fresh and new way. It wouldn't just be some empty ritual, but this would be time when we genuinely draw close to You. In Jesus' name, amen. And at that point, as you're led, you can come up and partake of that.